Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Tell us about teaching and being a door-to-door salesman. This is great stuff.
So I was a teacher, high school English teacher, for 9 years. And I trained teachers for several years as well. And I always say, being a high school teacher, teaching teenagers, is like being a door-to-door salesman. You're selling a product, except the customer absolutely does not want to purchase this product. And they are legally required by the government to do so. So that's the kind of tough audience that you have.
I love it. You know, we don't usually start shows this way, but that was too good. We were talking about that before we started recording. I had a good day today at school, but it was one of those days that was just, which is pretty much every day, which is physically and mentally taxing, especially in these COVID days. And that rings very true. They absolutely do not, I can't emphasize enough, they do not want what you're selling. Some days.
Here's one of the toughest things for people who've never taught. Here's one of the most surprising things. Teaching is, in addition to emotionally and intellectually exhausting, it is physically exhausting.
True.
By Friday, you are wiped out. And first year mm-hmm. teachers, when they first start teaching, by the second week, their voice is hoarse. You know, they're sore all over because it requires a lot of physical movement. It doesn't require explosive movement or sprinting mm-hmm. or anything, but you're constantly. It's like being on for 8 hours.
I want to come back to that in a minute. Who is this man dropping so much wisdom? Welcome, an official welcome. Awesome to meet you and to talk to you. This is Ben Guest. A little bit about Ben. 3-time champion and 2-time basketball coach of the year with a PhD in educational leadership. He spent 10 years in Namibia where he coached in the KBA. And he wrote the book, which will be the kind of the main thrust of our conversation. Zen and the Art of Coaching Basketball, Memoir of a Namibian Odyssey. Again, official welcome. And how are you today?
I'm good, Peter. Thanks for having me on. You have a great podcast. And as someone who loves literature, I love being on a podcast like this.
Oh, man, I appreciate that. I mean, we're going to talk literature. We're going to talk sports. Like, we're going to talk specifically basketball, which we all know is the greatest sport in the world. I'm loving it, man. I'm excited for this. I wanted to pick up on what you just said there. You were talking about the physically taxing part of it. I remember I did a teaching program right out of college and, you know, we were for the most part all 23, 24, you know, in our prime.
Just physically. Like teach for America.
Yeah. Similar. It's called the Place Corps based out of kind of similar to ACE through Notre Dame, but this is through Loyola Marymount down in your neck of the woods there in LA. And one of my teacher friends, and man, I think about this all the time. He would, on a Friday afternoon, when, you know, you want out, especially your first year teaching, you want to just leave it. He would stay at school no matter how long it took to get prepared for Monday. So if he was
Smart
there,
man.
If he was there till 9 p.m., then so be it. But he was done. He would go surfing on a Saturday morning. Saturday, Sunday were free. You know, the worst part about doing the work is thinking about the work, right? And,
I'm going to tell you what I did. And I, you know, if I had a family, if I was married with a family, I don't know that I could have done this.
Right.
But I graded everything the day I got it.
Oh.
So if the kids turned in an assignment, 7th period Tuesday, I stayed after school until they were all graded. And then you don't have that because what happens is those papers pile up. And I've seen so many first and second year teachers, especially this mental stress of like, yes. This thing is out there and it keeps getting bigger.
Yeah. Exactly.
And so a teacher I had in high school, a guy named John Romer, history teacher, he did that. And that really inspired me because it also shows the kids that, hey, you care.
Oh, definitely. Wow. First of all, you had 7 periods. That's a heck of a long day. But no, I love, you know, there's the ideal and there's the practical, and that is the ideal. And it's so cool that you made it the practical, like, yeah, just get it done. Oh man. Well, you shouted out, Mr. Romer, you said.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Where did you grow up? Where did you go to school? You know, what were you into as a kid? Were you a big reader from the very beginning? Were you, you know, a big athlete from the very beginning? I'd love to know a little bit about your,
sure,
your relationship with language and with sports as well.
Sure. So John Romer was my history teacher, and he also taught a class called Civil Liberties at Park School in Maryland, outside of Baltimore.
Okay. Okay.
And I had a great English teacher as well, a guy named Howard Berkowitz, who kind of inspired me. Nice. John and Howard, it was a private school. We called our teachers by their first name.
Uh-huh.
John and Howard both inspired me to become a teacher. Uh-huh. And before that, I grew up in Vermont up through eighth grade. Mm. So that was a big change, right? Eighth grade going from Vermont to Baltimore, Maryland.
Yeah.
And then college in Massachusetts. But you asked about growing up. So I was a huge reader, total library nerd, always in the library.
Nice.
So John Romer was the librarian. I also just got to know him because I was always in the library reading, and always had, and I had an hour bus ride to and from school. So always had a book that I was reading, and not an athlete at all. Didn't pick up a basketball till about 10th grade in high school. Didn't play for my high school team. Never played organized basketball. But fell in love with the sport. Mm-hmm. And when I, so after college, went Peace Corps in Namibia, finished the 2 years, then taught in the Mississippi Delta with a similar program called the Mississippi Teacher Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And there I started as an assistant coach. And the first year I was an assistant coach, we won the state championship. So this is public school, you know, big time sports in Mississippi. And that was a great experience.
Well, I mean, are you rocking the ring right now?
No, I should have, though. Come on. I have it at home.
Come on. I'd love to know, going back, what were you reading? I mean, were you reading, like, you know, history? Were you reading, like, Hardy Boys?
Fiction.
All the above?
So Stephen King was really my first introduction. And a cousin of mine, a guy named Jim Hazelton, who lives in Los Angeles, where I am now, he introduced me to Stephen King. And I'm sure everyone out there has seen the movie, The Shawshank Redemption. Mm. It's based on a Stephen King novella called Rita Hayworth in The Shawshank Redemption.
That's
so
right.
Growing up in the late 80s and early 90s, that was my single favorite story.
Mm.
And I always thought, this would make a great movie.
Yes.
And they made an even better movie than I could have imagined. So Stephen King, and then I read fantasy. There was a great series called Guardians of the Flame. It's kind of a...
Okay.
Dungeons and Dragons take of you know, people that play Dungeons and Dragons get sucked into that world.
Right.
Dragonlance. I'm just thinking what I read in middle school. So fantasy, horror, things like, and comic books. I was a huge, I still am a huge fan of comic books. I don't read comic books so much anymore,
sure.
But the medium is a genius medium. And we're recording this right now when the comic book Mouse or Maws,
right,
is being censored by a lot of school boards.
Right.
And it's a comic book that was written in the 80s by Art Spiegelman. It uses mice and pigs as metaphors or symbols for the Holocaust. It's about his grandparents who survived the Holocaust, or his parents, I'm sorry, who survived the Holocaust. Right. And so anyway, the medium of comic books is an amazing medium. Now, we use it 99% of the time to tell stories of superheroes and tights, but it's, sure, an incredibly powerful medium. So comic books, fantasy, that's what I was reading growing up.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know what to say about trying to outlaw Mouse. I mean, how do you, I mean, I don't even, I mean, like you said, I mean, literally the son of writing about his father, I mean, through the allegory, and it's just, it absolutely boggles the mind. Absolutely boggles the mind, yeah. There are at least two volumes, correct?
Yes, two volumes.
Okay. Yeah, I have both in my classroom, and I was like,
I had them in my classroom too. The kid,
right?
You know, we always had reading time once a week, and
yeah,
kids loved it.
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah, it's a shame. But won the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah, with good reason. I mean, just an incredible work of art. Talking about, you know, having that hour bus ride back in the day, and I'm like, man, you know, I just turned 42, and it's like, I've kind of become like, you know, I'm looking at my cell phone all the time, looking at my cell phone. Like I just miss an hour on a subway. Not that I'm in a subway area or whatever. And just reading, you know, like you have an hour, what are you going to do with it? Instead of like, just, you know, checking your email 20 times. I'd love to knock out an hour of reading, you know, man. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the book, you do talk about how basketball, you were late to basketball. I think of like, there's a great piece from like, one of Mario Puzo's books. He talks about like how this guy is late to driving in life. Like he doesn't learn to drive till he's in his 30s or 40s. And he becomes extremely careful about it. Or like the idea of like a convert to a religion, let's say, is maybe more passionate about it. I wonder if there's something about you coming kind of late to basketball that made you kind of embrace it more. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I wonder. I often wondered what would have happened if I'd started earlier. And the way I started, as I write in part of the book is Zen and the Art of Coaching Basketball. And it's mostly about my time coaching as a professional coach overseas in Namibia. I later went back to Namibia. But I write about how my sister in middle schools, my younger sister, played basketball. Right. And so my dad put a hoop up in the driveway. And that was when I was in maybe end of ninth grade, beginning of 10th grade. And then I just became addicted to shooting around and then watching the game and trying to replicate moves. And my sister didn't play basketball beyond middle school. If my dad hadn't put that hoop up,
yeah,
I never would have fallen in love with basketball.
Yeah. Butterfly effect.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, your whole life, right? I mean, why you went there, the coaching.
And most importantly, I think some of the central relationships that I still have in my life, people I've coached, whether it was 5 years ago or 20 years ago, I'm still in close contact with.
Oh, nothing beats that. The world is, follow me on this here, it's going to sound weird at first, but the world is possibly better for you not playing basketball early, because you would have been dunking on people, right? You would have been doing damage, right? I mean, you would have been, you know, you maybe retired 6 or 7 years ago, like a couple NBA championship rings, right? I mean, the world was not ready. The world was not ready. So what would be your scouting report when you were in your prime? What would be a scouting report? Are you like, you know, are you like a slasher? Are you a shooter? Like what was your scouting report?
The two things I did well, so I'm right-handed, but I really worked on my left hand till my left hand was even better than my right hand. So I could drive and finish left, which still to this day is a skill that I think more players can utilize because it surprises people.
No doubt.
And then just mid-range, you know, free throw line extended, just money from there. Okay. So one time I scrimmaged with the guys, or we were playing half court. And there were some new guys on the team, and you know, I hit like three straight shots. at that point, that was all I could do, was just, you know, catch and shoot a 15 footer. But I, you know, I just wished three straight. And I remember the guys were like, "Oh," and the other guy's like, "Yeah, coach could shoot," but I couldn't shoot threes. And it's interesting, you know. So I went to a small private school, so it's not like we were an athletic powerhouse. Mm-hmm. And a few years after I graduated, after I'd really gotten into basketball and just played a lot of pickup in college, I randomly played against, where was it? I think it was at Johns Hopkins at their gym, randomly played against a couple guys who were either my year or year ahead of me, year below me, mm-hmm. who had played on the high school team, were varsity starters, and just worked them. And it was like, oh man, if I'd started a few years earlier, I could have been you know, this little tidy, you know, private school league. I could have scored a few points.
You know, the quandaries or like scenarios that like guys will talk about, women will talk about who play basketball and all, or whatever, different sports. Joe Johnson, what was it like? I don't know, a month ago, 2 months ago, when COVID was really hitting the NBA.
Yeah, it came back.
Right, and everybody and their mom was getting a 10-day contract. And Joe Johnson came out, I think it was literally like one hoop, and he's 40, 41, but he can still, you know, he can still get to his spot. Could you, one play, right? Maybe in garbage time, like we could probably get our bucket, right?
In the NBA?
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
Okay. Thanks for bringing back to reality. Thanks for bringing back to reality. Yeah.
I'll give you a quick story. So in college, There's this guy named Perry Moss. He was about in his early 40s, and he was the son of one of the deans at the college, and he would just come and play pick up sometimes. And he had gotten a cup of coffee in the NBA with the 76ers in the 80s, Barkley 76ers.
Okay.
Like, he wasn't even the 12th man. He was like the 13th man that was activated for like three games his entire career. So this is somebody who just barely made the NBA. Right. And now he's in his early 40s. You know, his NBA days are 15 years behind him, maybe more. And he would just come out. He would, you couldn't get a hand on his dribble. He would come to half court. He would shoot it. He would say, "That's off." And as he's backpedaling, the ball would swish the net and he'd go awfully good. And you just realize, even more actually than attending an NBA game and sitting up close, but just playing with someone who literally was a 13th man on a 10-day contract, and seeing how incredibly, how much better, how much more skilled, how much more talented that person is than you. Yeah, no chance.
Night and day, right? I mean, absolute night and day. So it took me a minute there. That's a pretty good line. He said, "It's awfully good." That's a great line.
Yeah. So, isn't that good?
So I just looked him up on Wikipedia. He he was the American East Conference Men's Basketball Player of the Year.
Yeah, that's, Northeastern, right?
Absolutely no joke at Northeastern. He he actually played with Kevin Ollie. Talk about overlapping times in the CBA for the Connecticut Pride. He's in the New England Basketball Hall of Fame. Yeah, I'm obviously joking. There's same idea. We played in the alumni basketball tournament in high school a couple of years ago, and Isaac Fontaine played with the Lakers for a bit in the early Kobe days, and Shaq, you know, got a 10-day contract. And you never forget how to play basketball. If you're that good, you just, you know, you can create space, you know, the physicality is just a different, completely different than us. Than me.
There's a great video out there. I bet you've seen it. It's Brian Scalabrine, who
yes, I know you're talking
bench
about.
Player for a decade, played won a championship at the Celtics, Kevin Garnett Celtics, and people would just bash him. You know, he's a redheaded white guy, slow comparatively, and people would just bash him and be like, you know, I could score better than Brian Scalabrine, and so one time. I think it was even after he retired, because he's now a broadcaster for the Celtics. Yeah, and he's like, I'm going to rent a gym. Anybody that wants to talk can come and challenge me. And a couple guys who'd played Division I, right? So no joke, came and played him, and he recorded it and posted the video and said, you know, if you beat me, I'll give you whatever. And he just dominated them.
Yeah.
And he had a great line. My friend Dre, Andres Alvarez, who has a great podcast called Box Score Geeks. He mentioned this line to me that Scalabrine said. He said, "I'm closer to LeBron than you are to me," meaning a Division One, an average Division One player. "I'm closer to LeBron than you are to me."
Yeah.
Just because, in addition to size, it's all the angles. It's knowing if I pump fake somebody and then just give them a little bump, you know, they're gonna move this way or that way, and it's just. And Scalabrine was explaining this afterwards. Once I saw somebody shot, maybe they scored on me the first time or second time, but once I saw that and downloaded it into my computer and could cross-reference it with all the different moves and things that I know, it was a wrap.
Oh, no doubt. And yeah, I think he'd been out of the league for 4 or 5 years, even at least maybe. And when he did that. So it wasn't like he'd played the year before. No, that's a great illustration just of those differences. I want to go back to, I guess, sports writers who have inspired you.
Sure.
You know, because these great sports books are not just about sports, and we've been, I don't know, I'll say we've lived during the times, but there's always been great sports writers who, you know, I'm back to Grantland and all that, who really shone a light, you know, on society, the world as a whole, not just the basketball court, but who are some of the sports writers specifically who did and still do kind of inspire you?
Well, we're a similar age, so I wonder if you're familiar with this writer. It's a Sports Illustrated writer named Gary Smith, who just wrote about two or three long form features a year. And this is late 80s, early 90s. And what he did in telling, whether it was someone famous or someone not famous, what he did in telling a story and then elaborating on greater themes was amazing. And a number of his pieces appeared in an anthology, in a yearly anthology called The Best American Sports Writing.
Love it.
Edited by a guy named Glenn Stout. And that was something that once I got into sports, so around 10th grade, my father and I gifted that book to each other every year. Because my father played sports and loved sports. And that was really one of my introductions to great writing, because great sports writing is great writing.
Yes.
And cut to 20 years later, I'm working on my draft of Zen and the Art of Coaching Basketball. And I realized I could use an editor. And I'm looking at the bookshelf and I see all the volumes of The Best American Sports Writing, series editor Glenn Stout. I Google Glenn Stout. And long story short, a day later, I've engaged him as my editor for the book. So he edited the book and it was like having a master class in writing. Yeah.
So cool. I don't know if you can see it.
I see it right behind you.
Yep. The 100 years, you know, the 20th century.
Yeah.
There's some incredible work. Yeah, you have that in the acknowledgments about working with Glenn. I mean, I love that idea too. I have a lot of that where it's just like, you know, especially the worst they can say is no, you know, I've cold emails to writers and like, hey, would you mind speaking to my class? And no, the worst they can say is no. That's so cool that you had an editor before the day was done. That's incredible, man.
Yeah, it was great. It's a full circle moment for sure.
Yeah. For those of us who haven't, you know, tasted the NBA like yourself and myself, intramurals was everything, right?
I didn't even play intramurals except 1 year. I just played pickup with my friends.
Yeah.
A good friend of mine who I mentioned in the book, he's a longtime basketball coach now at Northampton High School in Western Mass. And he had the keys to the college gym.
Right.
And so we would just go down there late at night with some other guys from our dorm and play.
That reminded me of the college days. Same thing, you know, friend worked for the basketball team, nothing like it. I mean, just run after run after run. Mm-hmm. So were you a fan of Hakeem or both?
I was definitely an Olajuwon fan. That era, who I really loved was Scottie Pippen and Grant Hill were my two guys. But Hakeem, I write about Hakeem in the book because I would watch his footwork and then go out and try to replicate his footwork on the basketball hoop in the driveway. And so that was sort of like, that was the appetizer that led me to this great buffet of love and basketball.
Right. So help me with the timeline. So college graduation, you worked for a bit, then Namibia with the Peace Corps?
No, right. Well, yeah.
Or right into high school. Right into high school coaching. High school coaching was when?
No, you were right. So graduated college in May of 97 and then started Peace Corps end of October 97. But in between, I had a short-term job at Johns Hopkins Hospital in their public affairs department. And it was this place that, if you think in the context of a hospital, is completely unimportant, right? We're doing the least important work that a hospital does. And some people took that job very seriously. And it was all these cubicles and people writing these tough pieces on doctors and research that was going on at the hospital. And you could sort of see how somebody could get trapped in that rat race. And I reference a person I later met in Oxford, Mississippi, a guy named Ron Shapiro, Ronzo. And he had a juice shop and he was an old hippie. And he had a great line. He said, if you win the rat race, you're still a rat.
Right. Yeah. I pictured him with like a great, great ponytail maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, so he has a beard and long hair.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, no, I mean, the fact you had in the book, you had people literally like measuring their cubicles. I mean, if that's not allegory or symbolism right there. Right. I mean, like, wow, man. So when you coached high school basketball, you had the chance, like you said, you were the assistant coach. Was it Coach Willis?
Coach Willis. Yeah, George Willis. Legendary coach in high school, Mississippi.
Yeah, legendary coach. You know, he sounded like he could definitely ball in his own time and was, you know, beloved and also maybe a little bit feared, but a great coach, a legendary coach. And then you talk about, I saw myself and like, you know, young coach wanting to, you know, go to the clinics and stuff. I went, actually, I can probably remember the exact year, 2012 or 13 to Vegas. You know, they have the Nike one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I took my notes and the whole deal, got to see some greats. Never forget Bob Huggins, who is as old school can be.
He's a yeller.
Oh, he is a yeller. One thing I did think was pretty cool was when you talked about the whole idea of like running, you talk about running suicides and all these negative terms and violent terms that we associate with it. But he talked about kind of like an objective way, like he would use the bike, like, hey, you know, you're going to go at this, you know, 3 incline for this long, which I thought was very practical for a coach. Like you didn't have to punish the whole team, you know, blah, blah, blah. But that's a whole different story. But old school, he's still coaching. Those type of coaches aren't around that much anymore. They are, but you know, obviously Bobby Knight he flamed out in many ways. And you talked about going to Bobby Knight's camp. I mean, you know, if you ever watch his YouTube like bloopers, mm-hmm. you thought that, you know, you're just like, wow. And he was a yeller and a screamer and a grabber. You talked about even Coach K, a lot of F words, a lot of yelling. And you said that you kind of, you know, you took that to heart. Was that like, hey, I don't really have, I'm young, I don't really have a personality yet as a coach? Is that like, hey, I've seen these people are successful, wins and losses? What was it that made you, like, was that within your personality already? Did you feel like you had that, or did you feel like that was an affectation?
Well, that's a good question. I think as a young teacher, and then a few years later as a young coach, mm-hmm. I had the same core issue, which was, I was overly concerned with respect.
Yes.
The students need to respect me.
Right, right, right.
The
right.
Players need to respect me. And that's very much a model of control. I tell you to read this page, do this mm-hmm. assignment, mm-hmm. run this drill, mm-hmm. whatever. My word is law.
Yeah.
And that comes from insecurity. That comes from being worried that you won't be respected, mm-hmm. being worried that the students won't do what you say or the players mm-hmm. won't do what you say. Mm-hmm. And it's a fucked up way to coach. And as I've grown as a person, I've been able to recognize what was driving that insecurity, or what was driving that behavior was insecurity. And when I went back to coaching as an older coach, it was much more about relationships. It wasn't about, am I right or am I wrong, or are you right or are you wrong? It's about trying, and I think this is true for sports, I think it's true for teaching, and I think it's true for life. Our job here as human beings is to try to help those around us be better people and allow those around us to help us be a better person. That's it. Just, we're all doing the best we can at any given moment. And we all need some help and some empathy and some sympathy. Mm-hmm. And we all need to help each other be better. And the great irony, Peter, is the less I focused. So the other thing as a young coach, in addition to respect, I was consumed with winning and losing. And when I returned to coaching in my late 30s, I said, the wins and losses aren't important. I've learned from being a young coach that what I want to focus on is positive relationships. And the more I focused on positive relationships, the more I won. I won more than I ever had.
Right.
So it's kind of an interesting metaphor for life.
No doubt. We've kind of danced around a little bit, but, you know, more specifically about the book, Zen and the Art of Coaching Basketball. What made you decide to write the book? How did you come to that time?
Two things. So I know I had a great story, And as one of the blurbers said, it's like it's a modern day Hoosiers. It's a right? Hoosiers set in Southern Africa. And it has an unbelievable ending. And, you know, we can spoil it or not. It's up to you. So I knew I had a great story just from having told people about what happened. And people will always be like, man, that should be a movie. And so that was the first piece. And the second piece was COVID happened. And now I was still in Namibia. I was lecturing at a university, teaching teachers.
Oh, you were still there. Okay.
I was still there. And I kind of got stuck there a little bit. Stuck in the sense that at first, you know, a lot of flights were canceled. And then after that, Namibia was a relatively safe place to be for many months during the pandemic. So it just made sense ultimately to stay there and try to ride it out there rather than back home. Although I didn't really know that at the time. It was a tough decision. And so now I have all this time on my hands. And I said, well, let me try to write this up as a book. It'll be a good learning experience. And it was a good learning experience. And I'm happy with how the book came out. And I'm really happy with how people have responded to the book. And in the world of publishing, my sales are minuscule. I sold less than 1,000 books. And I still get a thrill because I self-publish, so I can see all my numbers on Kindle, on the back end of Kindle, on the back end of Amazon's platform. So it's available as an ebook, paperback, and hardcover. I can see on the back end every day, okay, two people bought a paperback, one person bought a ebook. And I do a lot of promotion. I published November 1st, 2021. I did a lot of promotion those first couple of weeks. Now, for 2 months, I haven't done any promotion. Mm-hmm. And we're recording this in mid-February. And I just get a kick when I see two books sold yesterday. Like I just checked this morning, a paperback and an ebook sold yesterday. Those are people who don't know me, who've never met me, who are just hearing about the book through a podcast like yours or through word of mouth, because I'm not promoting it at all anymore. This will be the last podcast interview I do, I think. And so it's a thrill, and it has average 5-star review on Amazon. And
nice.
Just the first time I got a written review on Amazon from somebody I didn't know, that's a thrill, right? Because someone took the time, they read your book, then they took the time to write about it. So I just get the kick out of all of that, because ultimately art is about connecting with people.
No doubt about it.
So that's the final process of writing and publishing a book, is people responding to it.
What are some of the feedback that stood out to you that was like surprising or funny or profound?
Man, through this whole process, through like my early readers, through working with Glenn, through publishing it now, the book, it's a short book, maybe just 140 pages, and it's sort of split in half. Everything up to when we start the professional league team. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of coaching high school in Mississippi, and then coaching high school in Namibia. And then there's this big decision. So the first year I coached high school in undefeated. And we made it all the way to the championship game for the capital city, Windhoek. And I knew before the game started, we were going to win. And I was excited. Yeah. I already kind of had my mind, like my little speech I was going to say. And we lost by 4 points. Mm-hmm. I still think about it. And from that loss, we had 6 seniors on the team and 10 guys played. I used the platoon system, 5 in and 5 out. And so I talked with the captain, guy named Seppo, kid named Seppo. And I said, Seppo, what do you want to do? Because he was playing for a professional league team. In Namibia, you can play for high school and for professional league at the same time. And I said, I'm thinking we should take the 6 seniors and some of the other guys and start our own team, own professional team. And Seppo looks at me, and the name of the team is Blue Devils. And he said, Blue Devils for life. And so that's the first half of the book. And the second half of the book is just the playoffs, the professional league playoffs. So I will spoil it. So spoiler warning, we went 500 in the regular season, barely made the playoffs, and then went undefeated in the playoffs and won the championship. It was the biggest upset in league history. And that's the second half of the book. And that second half was based on weekly emails that I was sending back to family and friends kind of in real time.
Okay.
And so the surprising thing about this project is that I think both halves work, but I get much more positive feedback on the second half. Mm. And I was talking to Glenn one day and I was like, it's great, but it also kind of sucks. Like, cause that was based on these emails, which makes sense. Cause now I have like real time material,
right,
conversations that I'm quoting, things that I'm, you know, writing at the time to sort of reference. But it's also like the part of the book that just moves. Once you get to that section, yeah, the book is just, it's like the roller coaster is going all the way up and now we're just dropped.
Right.
And it's sort of, it was like a bittersweet thing of like, well, the best part of the book is just based on some emails I wrote 5 years ago.
The book starts off with the epigraph. Help me with the pronunciation. Eugen Herigel?
I'm guessing that's it. I don't know for sure.
From Zen and the Art of Archery, quote, you mm-hmm. have a much too willful will. What a great phrase. You think that what you do not do yourself does not happen. Right. Goes totally to what you were saying about, you know, imposing your will as a teacher and insecurities mm-hmm. and all of that. The first chapter is called The Moment. And I really like it because I'm just kind of realizing this now. You did kind of like an outsider's thing where you kind of, in some ways, you ended where you began with Vincent. Right.
Yep.
And it's not necessarily mm-hmm. the ending of the book because there is that 6 years later, but, you know, deep breath in, deep breath out. I like, you know, use the italics to really show the thoughts. So you set up that Vincent, who never plays and is okay with that, just one of those great, great guys on the end of the bench. He gets the call in the key moments. Right. And then we come back to that later on. Part two is a back and forth that we talked about the Peace Corps. And then you just kind of started coaching on a lark, right?
Yeah.
Was it was Kiki and it was just kind of like, this was outside of school, or how did the team even come together? The high school team.
Sure. So after Peace Corps, I then taught in the Mississippi Delta. Mm-hmm. And that's when I was an assistant coach for Mr. Willis. And then a couple of years after that, I think still having the shine of having won a championship as an assistant coach, I was hired by another public school to be their head coach. I did that for a year. And that's where I had that idea, the wrong idea of I'm in charge. It's about wins and losses. It's about respect. And we went 10-13, which isn't a terrible record, but it's a losing record. Mm-hmm. And that was 19 years ago. And I'm not in touch with anybody from that team I coached. So that was the big lesson that I learned, is that coaching is about people. It's about relationships. And wins and losses are much less important than building positive relationships. To go back to that quote of trying to impose your will. So I mentioned my high school English teacher, Howard Berkowitz. And after I became a teacher, I was back in Baltimore and we went out to dinner. And I thanked him and we talked about teaching. And he had this great line where he said, a lot of teachers, after about 5 years, they look up and they realize, oh shit, there are students, there are kids out there. There are other human beings out there. Because when you first start as a teacher, as a coach, probably most things when you're dealing with people, you're so focused on what you're doing. You're not really taking into account the other human beings who are sharing mm-hmm. the space with you. Mm-hmm. And that was, so that quote from Zen and the Art of Archery, it reminds me of Howard's quote of, you know, it's not about imposing your will on somebody else. Mm-hmm. It's about everybody having this experience together.
No doubt. Well, yeah, that quote really rings true. I thought when you said out there, I thought you meant more of like the world, but I think you mean like the classroom, right?
Like I look up from my podium.
Right.
And there's 30 kids sitting at fucking desks in front of me that I haven't even noticed. Because I'm so, like, I got my lesson plan and my shit on the board.
Yeah.
And I notice it when somebody misbehaves. But other than that, it's just about what I'm doing. So you see a lot of first year teachers, they talk way too much.
No doubt.
Because they think they have to facilitate everything. Right. They think if they don't do it, it won't happen. But you and I as veteran teachers know that's not the case.
The sage on the stage, they call that, right?
Love it. Love that quote.
Yeah. Just, you know, the book is great in so many ways. And one is just learning about Namibia's history. Mm-hmm. It sounds like location is kind of the word for like neighborhood, but it maybe has maybe more of a connotation of like outer, like.
Location outer would be similar. We talked miles at the top. It would be similar to ghetto. not the way that we use the word ghetto here in America, but the way that the word ghetto was used under Nazi Germany, which is a place where people were partitioned off. Right. So in Namibia's history, they were under apartheid, under South African rule, and different tribes, different African tribes, Namibian tribes, were sectioned off into different ghettos or different locations is the term they use. So the one tribe is the Ovambo tribe. So there's the Ovambo location, there was the Herero location, there was so different tribes, different different locations where they were forced to live, and they couldn't travel from that location without papers, etc. So Namibia achieved independence in 1990, and the remnants of those things are still around, although the country has changed an incredible amount. There's still this, I think, trauma around all this terrible history.
I mean, I'm embarrassed to say I didn't even know that apartheid reached Namibia. Obviously, I knew about South Africa, but, you know, and then it's like, okay, where the, is it Windhoek or another one? You said it was like just 2 miles from Angola. I think it was the other town.
Ngela, where I served as a volunteer.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, just, and then, you know, that got me, your book got me looking into Namibia's history with apartheid. And then there's, you know, Cuba was involved in Angola. And, you know, I'd known about like Che Guevara. And, you know, it just really reminds you that history is not that far behind, as the Mississippian Faulkner would have said about, you know, the past is not even past, that type of thing. I think I'm paraphrasing. Yeah. But
the past isn't past. What is it? The past isn't dead. It's not even past.
Right. Right. But yeah, I mean, I was just amazed.
To your point, Peter, and we're far afield of literature at the moment. This is important, I think. So I started my Peace Corps service in 1997, October of 1997 in Namibia. So that's just 7 years after independence.
Exactly, 7 years, nothing.
And this was a great learning experience for me about what it is to be an American. Because under apartheid, the U.S. supported the white apartheid government. In fact, Dick Cheney famously said that Nelson Mandela was a terrorist. Now, Nelson Mandela is regarded as one of the great humanitarians of our time, up there with Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr.
Right.
And Cuba was supporting the Namibian freedom fighters who were staging from Angola because they had either left or they had left Namibia to start the armed struggle for independence. So Cuba, this country that we grow up in America, or that we learn growing up in America, is this evil communist country was supporting the good guys, right? People fighting for freedom, fighting for independence. And we were supporting the bad guys, the racists who were partitioning off Black people by their tribe and treating people terribly. So in fact, it was inspired by the Nazi regime. So it's, you know, that's when you realize the same kind of thing, like, oh shit, there are kids out there. Oh shit, there are students out there. It's like, oh shit, we're not the good guys. Right. We tell ourselves we're the good guys, right, but we're not.
Right. Yeah, I mean, how do you possibly justify being on the side of the white South African government? I mean, there's other than they have what, diamonds and
you know, there's money. It's always money.
Oh my gosh. Well, yeah, I mean, there's some great lines about the distance between the present and the past when you talk about just being, you know, a few miles or 20 minutes or 30 minutes away from, you know, very, very rural areas, and then into more like city-like. One of the chapters is called Portrait of the Art of the Coach as a Young Man, and we talked about that. But you make the great.
Do you like that James Joyce shout-out?
Hey, I love it. What an incredibly baffling and difficult book, but what a great book.
Yeah, right. That one I got through. Ulysses, even as a Peace Corps volunteer with all the time in the world, couldn't get through that one.
Not happening.
Never gave. What was the third? What was the last one he did?
Was it the Dubliners?
More Dubliners, maybe. That seems supposed to be more incomprehensible than Ulysses.
Haven't dealt with it. But you make the great distinction between, you know, when you coached that high school team, you talked about it was win, win, win. yelling, screaming, run suicides, you know, my way or the highway, versus the middle school that you also coach, which was development, mm-hmm. have fun, build relationships.
Mm-hmm. And everybody plays.
Everybody plays. And I loved your platoon system, right? And, but you did talk about how one of the high school games, you'd done the less is more.
Yeah.
And it had worked.
And it worked.
Why no follow-up? Was it just, again, tied into the, like...
That's a great question.
You know?
Right.
It worked.
What? Like, this thing? Mm-hmm. So I was, as a young high school coach, I was approaching things from the Bob Knight, Bob Huggins, Coach K school.
Robert Montgomery Knight, screen. Yes.
Yeah, the general. And, but there were these other examples of coaching out there. Most notably, Phil Jackson, who's the winningest professional coach ever, or NBA coach. And but it also won championships in the CBA, won championships as a mm-hmm. player. Mm-hmm. And so for one game as this young coach, burning with competitiveness, I thought, I'm just going to sit on the bench. I'm not going to yell out instructions. I'm not going to yell out plays. I'm just going to sit, not try to impose my will. Mm-hmm. And we were playing a much bigger school, Brandon High School, 5A school. We were just 2A. And we're playing at their place. And we beat them. And it was the biggest win of the season. It was another huge upset. Mm-hmm. But I had a much too willful will. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a conscious thought, but it was so easy to revert back to the other way. I call it mm-hmm. trauma coaching, mm-hmm. the other way of coaching, because now I'm being active and I'm doing things. And I'll just give you a very quick, fun story. So now I published this book last year, and I have a podcast, which people can find at benbo.substack.com. Benbo's my family nickname, Benbo, benbo.substack.com.
Okay,
I mostly interview other writers. And so I've interviewed a number of sports writers. And somebody who knew I was publishing this book, and he read it, he said, you know, I've interviewed Phil Jackson a couple times. I can send you his email.
Oh.
So he did. And I emailed Phil Jackson and said, hey, you know, I wrote this book. I'd love to send you a copy. You kind of inspired me.
Right.
You did inspire me. You did inspire me. And he certainly inspired me even beyond coaching to try meditation, which is something that has been incredibly helpful. He emailed back 20 minutes later. And so I sent him a couple copies of the book, and we sort of have this little email correspondence. Nice. So again, another full circle moment.
Yes. Now,
but it was just stupid. Oh. That's why I didn't keep doing the Phil Jackson method. Okay. I was just stupid.
In a word, if he were sitting in that chair that you're sitting in right now, he has the biggest shoulders known to man, right?
Him and Kevin McHale.
He was sitting, him and McHale, he'd sit in that special chair. That is so freaking cool that you talk to him. So you mm-hmm. you started your coaching, you know, days in the late 90s, early 2000s. It's that cool in between with Bobby Knight, where he was, you know, in the, you know, those type of coaches were going out of favor for the, you know, more so.
Yeah.
And like you said, if Phil Jackson was just like a little cutesy coach who, you know, did Zen, but he won, you know, which obviously made it so much different. Tell us a little bit about how, you know, you had this great, the chapter is called The Epiphany in the Mississippi Delta. How did you get into meditation? You would later start your practices in Namibia with the meditation. Mm-hmm. It obviously helped you personally. It obviously, you know, helps your teams to focus. How did you get into meditation? How has that helped you?
Yeah, that was the primary influence for that was Phil Jackson. Mm-hmm. And Phil Jackson has written a number of books about basketball, coaching basketball, his experience, his life in basketball. And in every book, he talks about meditation and how meditation has helped him. And Phil Jackson is my favorite coach, probably. Although I'm working on another project right now with a retired NBA player. And he played for Phil Jackson with the Bulls, and he played for Dean Smith at the University of North Carolina.
You're not going to drop that name? Wait a minute. Michael Jordan?
No, not Michael Jordan. But his locker was right next to Michael Jordan's.
Okay.
They're both UNC guys. And so in this project that I'm working on right now, I've really grown my estimation of Dean Smith, which is already super high. It's just grown. I mean, Dean Smith is just a wonderful person. But anyway, Phil Jackson wrote about meditation, and he was my favorite coach. He's my favorite coach. And as I got into my 30s, I thought I should try meditation. And then one day I was living in Atlanta. I was working for education consulting. I was consulting for an education foundation in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And where I lived in Lake Claire, I was walking to this breakfast spot that I liked. And there was a yoga studio that offered meditation lessons. And so I just started taking meditation lessons. And it's the most helpful thing that I've done as an adult. It just makes you more present and makes you calmer. And people have the wrong idea a lot of times who haven't meditated that your mind is supposed to become clear. And that's not it at all. It's more, you just become aware of your thoughts and they become like clouds in the sky, not pouring rain and thunder and lightning, but just distant clouds that are crossing your plane of thought.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, Phil Jackson, you know, he flipped the script so much. I mean, not that he was the first to do it, Wooden would do and all that, but I mean, right, he would give his players books that he felt were tailored to them, right? Yep. I was lucky enough to coach under Bob Alanese down in SoCal, who was a John Wooden disciple. Mm-hmm. And he would, you know, a lot of the first part of practice, like your practices, would be without a basketball sometimes, straight footwork, Z cuts, V cut, right? Mm-hmm. Just working on those things and really getting focused. And I love how, like, throughout the book, there were a couple times where some of the opponents, and it was mostly joking, but they'd kind of like clown on what you were doing. Mm-hmm. But obviously, you know, it worked. I do want to leave the reader with a little bit of mystery. The basketball scenes in itself are not worthy of reading this book. The meditation itself, the history of Namibia, the connections that you get with the team. So you have this huge win, which you call the biggest upset, it's objectively the biggest upset in KBA history, the Namibian Pro League. Mm-hmm. And you talk about, quote, don't get too high or too low. You've been preaching that. And you followed that yourself in prepping for the finals, right? You said, don't get, when I wonder if you've seen this Brad Stevens video, where I want to say, so he's coaching at not Purdue, Butler, right?
Butler.
Mm-hmm. So Brad Stevens is coaching at Butler. His team, I want to say they're down by one. They make it down Final Four, playoffs, NCAA. They make a huge turnover, like traveling, like without what's the word? Unsolicited or unforced travel. Everyone in the whole arena and probably on TV at home. Oh my God. Like, that's it. We lost. Not a single thing on his face, not a crinkle on his face. He simply subs in another player. Everyone else thinks the game's over, right? The player makes a steal in the backcourt layup. They win the game. The crowd goes crazy. The players are jumping around. Brad Stevens had a look on his face like it could not have been more neutral. Do you know what I'm talking about? Maybe if not that exact play. Right.
Well, I know in general. Yeah. And that's the whole point of that's something again where meditation helps in terms of that you're not tied to the outcome of something. Mm-hmm. In this case, basketball, you're just tied to the experience, and the experience is going to be interesting either way,
to say the least. I felt like I got to know some of the players, you know, towards the end, you talk about one of the players, you said, hey, do you want to use a pseudonym? He said, nope. You know, let's tell it like it is. And shoot, it would make a heck of a movie. You really get invested with the players and obviously with you as the coach. Shout it out. Where Amazon? Do you have any?
Self-published, and it's exclusively on Amazon. It's called Zen in the Art of Coaching Basketball, Memoir of a Namibian Odyssey. And then on my Substack, which is a combination news, email newsletter, and podcast, totally free, I interview authors. And we just did a series of how to publish your own book, how to plan, write, edit, and self-publish your own book and market. So check that out.
And are you
at benbow.substack.com.
And I'll definitely put that in the episode notes. Are you in screenwriting as well?
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Awesome.
So
awesome.
I'm doing my MFA in film production at USC right now. Which I got to get to class.
It's been so awesome talking to you. Like I said, I'll put all the notes and everything in the episode notes. Been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for sharing your odyssey. Here's the James Joyce, pun there, the Homer one. It's been awesome talking to you. Have a great class, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks for everything you do, Peter. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate you. Take care. Huh?
Cheers.
I want to thank our guest today, Ben Guest. I wish him continued good luck with his writing and so looking forward to continuing to following his career. Thank you for listening to the Chills of World podcast. You can now subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also ask for it by name using Alexa, find it on Stitcher, Spotify, and on Amazon Music. You can follow me on Instagram where I'm at Chills of World podcast, all one word, or on Twitter where I'm at Chills at Will P-O-1, the digit 1. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look at an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills at Will podcast is Wind Down instrumental version, and the other song played on this episode was, fittingly enough, Hoops instrumental by Matt Whitehour, and both songs are used through archesaudio.com. Please tune in for episode 110 with Bryce Hedstrom, el padrino of comprehensible input in the foreign language classroom, widely recognized as an outstanding world language teacher with more than 25 years of experience at all levels. A frequent regional, state, and national presenter, he is known for helping world language teachers to enhance their existing programs by incorporating many strategies that emphasize social awareness, interpersonal communication, and varied reading techniques in the classroom. The episode will air on March 15th. Today's episode with Ben Guest is the first of 5 this week. On Monday, March 21st, there will be a drawing for a $100 gift card to bookshop.org. In order to enter the drawing, first, DM me on Twitter by Monday, March 21st at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time with the 5 code words that are contained, 1 per episode, within each day's podcast. Secondly, retweet any 5 tweets that have episode links for episodes 109 to 113 with Ben Guest, Bryce Hedstrom, Taylor Bias, James Tate Hill, and Nicole Santa Cruz, respectively. And today's code word, and again, you're going to have 1 code word each day this week for episodes 109 to 113. Today's code word is Tobias. T-O-B-I-A-S, Tobias. For now, thanks again for listening, and I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts by writers with mad skills, like Ben Guest, whose work gives you chills at will.